That's okay. Okay, so like last month, we're going to hear another biography today, so a different person. And the person I've picked for today's story is someone who I think nobody will have heard of before. She's from Pakistan, and I need to give you a little bit of context before we get into the story. But her name, I'll write down her name so that you can sort of see what it looks like. So the lady we're going to speak about today is Bilquis Sheikh, and that's how it's written there. Okay. So context. I need to tell you a little bit about Pakistan, because this story takes place in Pakistan, where currently 0.8% of the population is Protestant Christian. So it's 98% Muslim, and the other 2% is made up of a number of different religions. But the state religion is Islam. So Christians are very much the minority. And even today, Christians make up the sort of the poorest class. They're the lowest of the low. In fact, in Pakistan, they're nicknamed the sweepers, the street sweepers. The reason why they're always in the lower class is because there are rules in Pakistan. You cannot hold a high position in government or in any sort of influential office if you are not a Muslim. And in addition to that, you also can't, there are certain jobs which Christians can't have. So they're sort of cut out of the top paid sort of jobs. Also, they're cut out of education. So there's certain universities that are, you know, really you cannot be, you can't be anything other than a Muslim. And so generally Christians don't have access to education. They cannot get the high-paid jobs. Christians generally, they're seen as they're not to be trusted because it's a Muslim country, and if you're a Christian, you're not to be trusted. So they generally don't get opportunities. For example, if a Muslim was going for a job and a Christian, the Muslim would generally get it, unless the employer had was maybe just thought differently. But generally, Christians don't have employment. They don't get the education opportunities. And on top of that, there's very, very strict laws in Pakistan called the blasphemy laws, which mean that you are not allowed to convert someone from out of Islam, pretty much. So, for example, if a Christian gave a Bible to a Muslim, they could actually be sentenced to death. They have capital punishment in Pakistan, and the crime for converting someone or attempting to convert someone who is a Muslim is actually death. So you can imagine that the Christians kind of stick to themselves. And there are certain areas in Pakistan which are the slum areas, and that's pretty much where the Christians live. So only 0.8% of the population is Protestant Christian in Pakistan, and that's kind of the reason. So that's the context, and that's now in Pakistan, and actually that hasn't changed a lot. So this story, this lady here that I'll be speaking about, she lived in the 1960s. Well, that's where I'm going to pick up the story. And her in that time, in that era of Pakistan, it was very, very similar to what it is now. So actually it hasn't changed a lot, and those laws are still current. And I was reading some newspaper articles about people recently in like the 2010 and so on, who were convicted under these blasphemy laws for doing something like saying something against the Prophet Muhammad or saying something against the Quran, and then as a result were sentenced to death. So Pakistan, an Islamic, a very strong Islamic country. Okay, now I need to give you a little bit of background about this lady here, because I'm not going to tell you her whole story, it'll take too long, but I'm just going to sort of pick it up halfway. Bilquis Sheikh was actually from a very, very wealthy and well-known family. In fact, she had a descendant who was a very famous person, which I had never heard of, Prince Hayat Khan in Pakistan. He was a general or something, and her family was a direct descendant. So they had been influential members in Pakistan for 700 years, and she was kind of seen as the high class, and she was also very wealthy woman. They had many estates. The family owned a lot of land across Pakistan. And also she was quite influential in government. She worked with a number of people to create a program which had a big impact on Pakistan's economy. So she was a very well-known sort of person, a very well-known figure. She married a general by the name of Khalid something, and Khalid Sheikh, that's right. And she married him, and he was, again, another influential person. He then became minister. He was Minister for the Interior in Pakistan. And she spent many of her married years traveling the world. She would do her shopping in London one weekend and then, you know, do her shopping in the high streets of Paris the next. She was living the high life, traveling first class, had apartments in Paris, London, all the big cities in Pakistan, and so on. So that was her life. But it all came crashing down when her husband, this general, said to her one day, I'm leaving you, and I'm going off to with someone else. And her marriage just broke apart very suddenly, and she found herself divorced and alone and very angry and very bitter against her husband, which could just kind of dispose of her like a rag. And she ended up moving from those apartments that she had, and she ended up coming back to Pakistan, and she didn't want to live in the cities and be in sort of the spotlight. She decided to move to a family estate, which was sort of in at the foot of the Himalaya Mountains. It was kind of a very small village near a fairly large city, but it was far enough removed that she felt that she was alone. So she had this family estate. It was quite small for her, you know, only about 25 bedrooms or something. And it was on a beautiful 12-acre property, but it was all kind of, the gardens were all a mess. But she moved there because she was so angry, so bitter, and she couldn't deal with anyone. And I think she kind of recognizes now she fell into a bit of a depression. So she kind of put all her energy in fixing up this property, and she made it beautiful. She made it show gardens, like with fountains and beautiful orchards and everything. She put all her energy into this garden and was looking for some sort of assurance and peace and trying somehow to piece her life back together. And she was using this beautiful location to do that. Of course, she was from a Muslim background. Her family were 700 years of Muslim influence there, and her family was very much very devout. She herself, though, because of this experience and because of her depression, thought that God had forgotten her. And so she just, you know, she did still do the ritual prayers and so on, but she used to miss a few, and she kept the Quran there, but she never really opened it, because why? Why bother? God had forsaken her anyway, and her life was misery. Why should she turn to him? So she wasn't particularly devout, but in her in her estate, she had 14 servants. Many of them were Muslim, but she actually did employ some Christians. She had a Christian chauffeur, she had a Christian maid, and her family kept saying, what are you doing? Why are you employing these Christian people to be a part of your staff? You know how untrustworthy they are. But she said, they're cheaper and they can do the job, so it's fine. So that's kind of where we're going to pick up the story. This is in 1966. She'd been living in this on this estate for about 5 or so years, and she was still searching for something, but she'd put all her energies into fixing up this beautiful place. But yeah, she was still quite lonely, angry, and depressed. So one day she was walking through her gardens, and it was in the evening, and as she was walking through, she suddenly felt uneasy, and she couldn't really work out what it was. She actually looked around her because she thought someone might have been there watching her or something. But then she felt something brush against her cheek, and there was a mist. A mist kind of came down on her. And she actually sort of screamed and jumped, and she ran in. And she actually thought, is that an evil spirit or something like that? Now, she was a very logical and rational person, but you see, her staff and a lot of the other people around her were quite superstitious, and they did believe in things like spirits and stuff, but she used to sort of sweep it aside. But she, at that point, she actually thought, is that an evil spirit? And the feeling she got and the chill she got down her spine made her actually run into the house. And just before she ran into the house, she felt a tap on her arm. And she turned around and there was nothing there. And she actually screamed. And as she ran into the house, her servants came thinking something had happened. And then she felt really silly because they were like, what? Are you okay? And she just said, I felt something in the garden. And they thought it was very strange. But one of her maids called Nurjan, who was a young Muslim, was very superstitious. And she actually said, maybe it is an evil spirit, that maybe there are spirits in the garden. And so Nurjan sort of said, please, Madam Sheikh, please call the priest, call the mullah, the Muslim priest, to come. And maybe he can sprinkle holy water on your garden. And, of course, Bilquis was like, I don't want any scrawny little priest walking around my garden throwing around holy water. And so she dismissed it, and she felt really ashamed and silly, like that, you know, that she would even think that, you know, that there would be an evil spirit or any sort of evil presence. However, the next day, her little grandson, now her grandson actually lived with her. She actually had adopted her grandson. His name was Mahmoud. She adopted him when he was about 2 or 3 years old. The reason she did that was because her youngest daughter, by the name of Tuni, had a very unhappy marriage and ended up divorcing, and her daughter was very scared that her son, Mahmoud, would go to her husband for custody. And her husband was quite a violent sort of man. And so in the end, Bilquis decided to adopt her grandson formally so that her grandson would live with her permanently. And Tuni would be able to visit at any time, but she was a doctor, she lived away and so on. And in that way, the grandson wouldn't be passed around between people and there wouldn't be custody issues. So one day Mahmoud, the very next day actually, Mahmoud was playing around, and the servants said to Bilquis and said, he's not eating. He's just sort of playing, but he's refusing to eat. And she called him and, you know, gave him some of his favorite Swiss chocolates that she'd imported from Switzerland just for him. And she said, you know, you have some of this. And he refused to eat. And all day he was just not wanting to eat a thing. And this was very unusual. And she felt quite worried about this. And the servants were trying to get him to take something. And finally Mahmoud said, my throat, I can't, I don't want to swallow. And so, again, Nurjan, the maid, was very scared and said, oh, maybe it's from yesterday. Maybe it's the evil spirit attacking your grandson. Maybe something's happening here. Please, please call the mullah to spray the holy water or do something. Pray over him. And, of course, Bilquis said, no, I'm taking him to a doctor. That's what I'm doing. So she did take him, but the doctor couldn't find anything wrong with him. And then she started to feel very scared, and she started to think, well, maybe I should call that priest to come. And so she did. And she called this Muslim priest, the mullah, to come, and he came. And she didn't really have a lot of time for him. She sort of had the body language. She was starting to tap her foot, and he was sort of doing his rituals. And then he started to read out of the Quran. And he was reading over the little boy who was sat there, and she was listening to the words, and she was listening about how Muhammad is the messenger of God and how they are hard against the unbelievers, and she was hearing all these familiar words, and she found herself wondering about herself and whether she would be classed as one of the unbelievers too. And of course the mullah said to her, you know, you should read your Quran, you should pick it up, you should read it. And she sort of nodded and read a few things out just to please him. But when he left, actually Mahmoud got better. And so Bilquis felt really confused and uneasy. She'd never really believed all of this kind of stuff, you know, the holy books and all of this. And then suddenly her grandson had gotten better. And so she felt out of obligation that she should perhaps do what this mullah had told her, and she did pick up the Quran, and she did try to read it, And, you know, she'd read it before when she was a child, but mainly reciting it and things like this. And she admired the beautiful poetry, but when she read the Quran, she was looking for comfort and assurance and peace. And each page she turned, she didn't quite find it. But in the Quran, there was a mention of this prophet, Jesus. The Muslims have actually got in their Quran, there's a couple of lines about Jesus and how he's a prophet and he was a good man. But they certainly don't believe that he was the Son of God. In fact, that is the highest form of blasphemy. And also in the Quran, it mentions Christians and Jews. They're the unbelievers. They're the people who've got it all wrong. And she knew from her early experience that the Christians, their holy book called the Bible, it was all falsified. It was all just, you know, they just made the whole thing up. And it was Muhammad who fixed it up, and his holy book, the Quran, is the real thing. But something in her was sparked, and she had a little bit of curiosity because she thought, what about those earlier holy books like the Bible? Maybe there's something in there. Maybe I could just have a look and see what's written in that early holy writing. And so she thought to herself, how am I going to get a Bible? You see, you can't just buy a Bible, and particularly where she lived, near the village, there was no way you could buy a Bible. And she couldn't really ask someone to give it to her because it was all illegal. But then she thought, no, I will ask someone. And she called her chauffeur and said to this chauffeur, his name was Manzoor, she said, Manzoor, I want you to get me a Bible. And he went white. And he just froze and said, sorry? And she said, I want you to get me a Bible. Now go and do it. And he just scuttled away. He was so scared. For someone of his position, a servant, to get a Bible and give it to someone of her position would be a death sentence. But that was what he had to do. He was her servant after all. Then a week passed and still no Bible. And she was getting impatient. She sort of was curious. She wanted to see what this illegal book, the Bible, had in it. And so she waited, and then she called Manzoor and said, where's my Bible? I asked you a whole week ago. And I said, get my Bible and get me a Bible, and you haven't got anything. And he said, oh, please, I just need more time. And she said, you've got one day or I fire you. Get me a Bible or you get out. And so he was so scared. But the next day, on a little table in the corner of a drawing room, a little Bible appeared mysteriously. And Bilquis saw it there, this grey, battered sort of copy. And she didn't thank him or anything. She didn't acknowledge it. But she did flick through. And she saw lots of words and put it down and forgot about it. But a while later, a couple of days later, her daughter came to visit, and it was a usual thing, and her daughter was playing around with Mahmoud in that drawing room, and she picked up this book and she flipped it open and said, Mom, you've got a Bible in here. What are you doing with a Bible? And Bilquis was like, what? Oh, yes, I was curious. And she said, Mom, it's a Bible. And she said, well, I'm just curious. There's no harm in seeing what's in there. I'm not going to do anything major with it. And so Tuni said, all right, flick it open, see what it says. Just open up anywhere and just see what it says. And so Bilquis, just out of good humour, flicked open the Bible and pointed to a verse, and then she read it. And the verse she read was in Romans. It was Romans 9:22, and I'll read it to you. Oops. This is what she read. I will call them my people who were not my people, and her beloved who was not beloved. And it shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called sons of the living God. And when she read those words, she read them in her mind. And Tuni was like, well, what does it say? What does this holy book say? And she couldn't read it out loud. It was as if those words were meant for her. And she shut the Bible quickly and just put it away and said, oh, nothing, don't worry. And then they went about their business. But later that night, Bilquis found herself going back to the Bible. And she opened it again. And she was just reading exactly where she'd read just a few hours before. And she flicked over to the next page and she was reading Romans chapter 10. And she came to the verse where it said, but what does it say? The word is near you, even in your mouth and in your heart, that if you confess with your mouth the Lord Jesus and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. And she thought to herself, this is a really different book. You know, the Quran was full of directives, commands, warnings, and her first encounter with the Bible was so different. It was about being saved. And if you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart, what about the 25,000 commands that you needed to do, or the things or the rituals? There didn't seem to be any of that. And who was this Jesus? And so all of these thoughts started to come into her mind. And she knew straight away that the Quran and the Bible were very different. And she had previously thought that perhaps all the holy books in the world were the same and they all kind of lead to the same God. But having read a little bit of the Quran and the Bible, she knew that they couldn't lead to the same God. They couldn't be the same thing. And then she started on this great journey. She started reading a bit of the Quran, more out of obligation, and because of her 700-year family history and the ancient traditions and culture and identity and everything that came with being a Muslim woman. And she started reading it, but then she found herself turning to the Bible, and she read bits of the Bible. Then she went back to the Quran, Bible, Quran, and she just found, like, there are two different books here. And she couldn't work out what to do with this, because she found herself being increasingly drawn to the Bible. And that was a very dangerous feeling. Now, she decided... One night, she was lying down after flicking between the Quran and the Bible when she had a dream. And in this dream, it was very, very vivid. It was more like a vision. It was something she really strongly remembered. In the dream, she was sat at a table and she had just invited someone into this house, and she knew that person to be Jesus. And in her dream, she sat at a table with Jesus, and they were sharing a meal together. And she didn't know how she knew it was Jesus, she just did. And then suddenly the dream changed, and she was on a mountain, and there was a man stood, and she knew that that man was John the Baptist. And she said, John the Baptist, where is Jesus? He was here a moment ago. Can you lead me to him? And then suddenly her dream sort of ended. And she actually ended her dream, but she was actually yelling out, John the Baptist, John the Baptist. And her servants rushed in and then were really embarrassed because they realized she was just dreaming. And she thought to herself, who is this John the Baptist? She'd never heard that name before. She didn't know who he could have been. And she just wondered about the dream. And it troubled her. And she felt like it wasn't a normal dream. And so the fact that she was going from the Quran, the Bible, and these dreams, all of this together started to make her very confused. And she decided to do something drastic. She decided to go and visit these missionaries who lived in her nearby village. Now, she didn't think much of missionaries. In fact, most of the people in Pakistan thought the missionaries, these Western people from, you know, America or England or something, they were pale, colourless, boring people who put all their energies into the poor people. They just devoted all their time to the sweepers. And what for? You know, and so they looked down on them as sort of silly, dim-witted, colourless people. So, but she thought, now they know about the Christian God. Maybe they will tell me about my dream. Maybe they have some answers. And so she got in her car one day. She excused her chauffeur. She didn't want anyone to know. And she drove to the village, and she was very scared She thought to herself, if anyone sees me walking into this house, you know, they're going to have questions. And she parked a little away, and she was sort of going to walk up, and as she walked up, she realized that there was a whole crowd of people coming out of the house. And so she stopped, and this crowd of people were just local village people and staff from the mission hospital, because these missionaries, they also worked in the hospital. And they all stopped, and just all the talking and chatter just went silent. And all these village people were looking, and they knew who she was. She was Madam Sheikh. And they all kind of just bowed and did the normal sort of traditional thing, and they just scuttled off. And there she was, stood. And she thought, well, we can't go back now. I'd have to go up to the door and see what's going to happen. So she went to the door and she knocked, and Mrs. Mitchell, who was the missionary's wife, opened the door. And when she opened the door, she just froze and said, oh, Madam Sheikh, what are you doing here? And she'd just finished a Bible study with all those village people, and then there was Madam Sheikh. And so Bilquis said, where is your husband, the Reverend? I have some questions for him. And Mrs. Mitchell said, oh, I'm so sorry, but he's away. He'll be back tomorrow, but maybe I can help you. And Bilquis looked at this young, thin, pale-looking woman and thought, don't know. But she'd come this far already, so she went in, and Mrs. Mitchell made tea, and they sat there. And then Bilquis said, Mrs. Mitchell, do you know about God? And Mrs. Mitchell said, well, I don't know much about him, but I do know him. And Bilquis thought, what a strange answer. Like, you know him? That was almost blasphemy to say that you know God. But she found herself being quite warm to this woman, and she ended up telling her the dream and about this person called John the Baptist. And Mrs. Mitchell showed her in the Bible how John the Baptist was there to show the way of all the people, to lead them to Jesus. And by the end of the evening, you know, Bilquis had a new little New Testament in her hand. The one that she'd been given by a chauffeur was in Old English. So the one she'd got now was in Modern English, and it was a New Testament. And Mrs. Mitchell sort of left her by saying, read the Gospel of John. Start from that. And so when she went home, she realized that maybe that dream, and maybe John the Baptist in her dream, was actually leading her to Jesus. And maybe there was something happening that was pushing her towards knowing who this prophet was, Jesus. And the next day, Mahmoud again had something wrong. He was screaming in the morning, holding his ear and screaming. And he was pale and he was a bit limp and he was crying and holding his ear. And Bilquis said, what's going on? What's happening? And she called her daughter and said, Toonie was a doctor. Toonie, what are we going to do? You know, what should we do? And she said, get him to the hospital. You need to get him now. Get him straight away. And she actually said, we won't be able to see him, but at least check him into the hospital and somebody will see him as soon as they can. And we'll arrange a little apartment for you so you can stay at the hospital and stay there and people will do the checks and so on. So they rushed him to the hospital. They ended up having to stay for a while he was being checked out. And she had a little apartment. And she was sat there in this little apartment waiting. And she'd brought with her Bible, her little New Testament, and the Quran. And she was again reading parts of the Quran and going through that and then looking at the Bible. But suddenly there was a power outage at the hospital. And she was a bit annoyed because there she was reading and now power outage. And there was a little knock at the door and a doctor who was an elderly nun. She came into the room and she brought all these candles and said, I'll set up candles for you, Madam Sheikh. It'll be okay. And the power outage, it'll be up again in a couple of hours. And so as she was setting up the candles and lighting the candles, she stopped and this doctor said, oh, Madam Sheikh, what are you doing with a Bible? And Bilquis said, oh, well, yes, I'm searching. I'm searching for God. And this doctor said, well, do you mind if I have a little sit down and have a little chat? She said, oh, take a seat. And so this elderly lady, Dr. Santiago, her name, she said, Bilquis, you must pray. Talk to God. Talk to him. Like we are talking now. Talk to him. And Bilquis sort of shook her head. It was like asking her to talk to the Taj Mahal. That's what it seemed like in her head. And she thought, yes, I know what prayer is. It's a ritual. You know, we do it 5 times a day. That's what prayer is. And Dr. Santiago said, no. Talk to God as if he were your father. And those words really stuck with Bilquis, because firstly, that was blasphemy. For a Muslim person to see God as your father is making God equal to you. The fact that you can have a relationship and talk to God on equal terms was blasphemous. But there was something about what this woman said that made her really think. And she, the next day when she went home and Mahmoud was fine, and she did wonder that perhaps the Lord had made his ear hurt to bring her to the hospital. When she went home that day, she couldn't get those words out of her head. Talk to God as if he were your father. And she remembered, you know, she had these really fond memories of childhood where she would sit, she would play with her father, and you know, her father would be he's a very important person. He was influential in government. He was, you know, he was doing all sorts of important things, and he'd be in his study and he'd be reading, but she could just run in and he would scoop her up and put her on his knee, and suddenly he would attend to her. And she wondered and thought, is God like that? Is God in any way like that? Would he actually, from all the things that he needs to do, would he actually turn and attend to me? And so later that night, she knelt down and she prayed. She prayed out loud. And it sounded very strange to her. She said, O God, God the Father, my Father, God, you, Father God. She was trying this out. And it all sounded very strange to her. But then she said, Father God. And suddenly it was as if someone had walked into the room. And she ended up being able just to talk in a normal way. And she said, you know, she spent hours talking to God as if he were her father. And she spoke and talked about her confusion. And finally she said, God, my father, which book is yours? Is it the Holy Quran or is it the Bible? And she felt like she could hear these words spoken directly to her. And the words were, in which book do you meet me? And she knew straight away it was the Bible. And she had very little sleep that night. And by the time she had gone to bed, it was already dawn. And when she sort of woke in the morning, she was very clear. And she knew that the Bible was true and that God, the God of the Bible, was the one and only God. Now that was huge. All her life, her identity, everything was wrapped up in the Quran. She was a Muslim woman in a Muslim country. She was a high-born Muslim woman. And now here she was, and she knew for sure that the Bible was 100% true and that the God of the Bible was the one true God. But the next day, she was thinking about this and she realized the cost. She thought to herself, I'm going to have to turn my back on everything I've known, my whole identity, everything. And she remembered back, She remembered being a young girl, age 7, something like that, and walking into Lahore, the big sort of city of Pakistan. She remembers her father taking her by the hand and walking her through the huge mosque, the grand mosque in Lahore. And she remembers seeing the mosaic tiles, the beautiful architecture, the huge domed walls, and her father saying, "Bilquis, this is our ancient tradition, and you have the privilege of being part of our ancient tradition." And she remembered his words. She remembered the wonder of being able to see all these people, all these other Muslims praying. And she remembered all the celebrations they had. And of course, that was her identity. That was everything she'd known. But also, she knew what would happen if she became a Christian. You know, she would lose her friends, she would lose her family, and she would also probably lose Mahmud, because she would be ruled by the courts as an unfit mother, a mother not able to take care of her child. So she knew that he would be probably taken away from her as well. Not only that, but her life would be in danger. She would have, her family would forsake her. There might even be a situation, and she knew many people who had this happen, where family members actually kill someone who's converted because of the shame it brings on the family. It's called honor killing. And she knew that that happened a lot. And she thought, that's me now. That could be me. My uncles, my brothers, they might be forced to take action against me. So not only would she lose her whole identity of her, everything she'd known in her life, she would lose her family, possibly her only son or grandson, Mahmud, and her life. And she flicked open the Bible again, and she read those verses in Matthew 10 that we heard about last week. The verse that says, "Whoever loves mother and father more than me is not worthy of me." And she slammed the Bible shut and she said, "Jesus, why? Why don't you compromise? Why? Why is it so hard? The cost is too great." And so she left her home and she traveled into the big cities of Pakistan and she distracted herself. She was shopping, she bought things, she distracted herself with everything that she used to enjoy. And she just wanted to go back home and forget about everything and just be as she was before, fairly neutral. And she wanted everything just to go back to normal. But of course, when she came back home, she knew that something had permanently changed in her and that she couldn't just forget about it and move on. She couldn't just lay it all aside. She'd found the truth and this wasn't going to let her go. Later that night, she flipped open the Bible again, and she'd never read Revelation, but she came to Revelation, and she was reading in the first few chapters, and she read Revelation 3:20, which says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hears my voice, he will open the door, and I'll come in and dine with him, and he with me." And she read that verse, and she thought, this is familiar. And then she remembered her first dream. And she thought, that was it. She'd opened the door. Jesus, and she knew it was Jesus, had walked in and she'd sat and shared a meal with Jesus. And then she realized that that dream was sent to her by God himself. And that he was telling her that this was going to happen. And suddenly she just fell to her knees that night. And she said, "Lord, the cost is huge, but I know you are true and I accept you into my life because you're God after all. So whatever happens, you can take control." And she was filled with joy. And she'd also read in Acts, she'd read about how these early Christians, when they believed, they were baptized with the Holy Spirit. She had no idea what this meant. But she said, "Lord, you did something to these people in Acts. Do that to me. Whatever that is, do that to me. Baptize me with the Holy Spirit. That's what I need." And at that moment, she felt an explosion of joy inside her. And she knew that the Lord had heard her. And all night, she was praying and praising the Lord, knowing that she had completely turned her back on everything she'd known, her entire identity, and the cost would be huge, but she knew that it was the right thing. And so, the next morning, it happened to be December the 25th, a pretty ordinary day in Pakistan, but not so ordinary elsewhere. And she woke up in the morning, her maids came in, and she was humming to herself, and her maids thought, what's happened to this woman? And one of her maids dropped something, and it sort of broke, and Bilqua said, oh, don't worry about it, don't worry, it's fine, we don't need to fuss about that. And the maids were quite shocked, because previously Bilqua was quite a hard taskmaster, and their clumsiness would be dealt out with very harsh scolding. And so they wondered what had happened to her. And even Mahmoud, five-year-old Mahmoud now, he said, Mama, why are you so smiley today? And she said, oh, well, because it's Christmas Day, she said. And Mahmoud said, what's that? And she said, it's the Christian day. It's the day that they celebrate Jesus. And Mahmoud had no idea what she was talking about. And so she said, it's just like Ramadan. It's just the same kind of thing. And today we're going to go to the Mitchells and you're going to see what Christmas is all about. So Mahmoud was fine with that. And they went and they arrived at the Mitchells' place, these missionaries. And she walked in and they were having a big sort of lunch and all sorts. There were heaps of people there. And of course, everyone was very surprised to see her. But she walked straight up to Mr. and Mrs. Mitchell and she said, I've become a Christian and I've been baptized with the Holy Spirit. And they sort of were really shocked and said, who taught you about these things? And she said, well, it's written in your holy book. And they were shocked. And Mrs. Mitchell, just against tradition, ran and gave her a huge bear hug and said, you know, welcome to the family. Welcome. And Bilqua's Sheikh started on a long journey of many lessons from that point on. So I'm not going to tell you all the different things that happened to her. I've just picked out a few things. So she'd been converted, but of course, as she knew, the cost would be very great. And so I've picked out a few things she learnt along the way, just to try and give you an idea of what happened next. One thing that she really learnt, and something that I also learned from reading her story, is she had a great sense of the Lord's presence. She called it living in His presence or living in the glory. That's her words for it, because as she was getting about her daily things, you know, she was still learning. She had a lot to learn, and her old selfishness and anger and snappiness and depression used to surface a lot. And she would make decisions and suddenly she would just feel like the Lord had left her or the glory had faded. And she realized that, oh, it was that choice I made. It was that the way I spoke to that person. And so she really learned to have a very, very sensitive spirit. And she felt the Lord's presence, and she knew that He was with her. And when the glory faded, she knew she had to repent of something. And so she literally went about her life like this. She was very conscious of the Lord being with her, and she was very conscious, if He wasn't, that she needed to repent and change, and there was something she needed to deal with. Now, one day she was going through her things, and she found a photo. It was a photo of herself and her former husband, and it was some event, and it was an official photo. And as she saw this photo, she was so angry. She had so much hate, and she looked at that photo and she prayed that the Lord would never ever convert that man, because she didn't want him to feel joy. She didn't want him to have any sense of joy, and she had all this joy in being saved, and she wanted nothing for this man. So she said, Lord, please do not ever come into his life and convert him in the same way. So, and then suddenly she just felt, no, hang on. And she felt very loud and clear. It was almost like the Lord was saying, and said, no, Bilquis, love your former husband. And she was quite shocked, and she said, love him? love him, why not forget him? What about we do that? And the Lord kept coming back and saying, no, love him, forgive him. And so Bilquis struggled with this and thought, no, I can forget him. I can forgive him and forget, but I cannot love this man. And she remembered all these incidents and memories came up into her mind, and she was full of hate. And the Lord said, you have to learn this. And she prayed, and she said, okay, Lord, teach me how. I can't love this man. And she said, you do it. You help me love him and forgive him properly. And she did. That very same moment, she felt like the Lord saying, now I can work. And she felt like a total change of attitude. Just moments before, she'd been praying that he would never be converted and he would spend his eternity in hell. But now, she looked at the photo and she didn't have that gush of hatred and anger. And she looked at that photo and she actually thought, I wish him well. And this was the first time she'd ever thought those things about him in the last 5 or so years. And then, because of that, she felt a huge weight lifting off her shoulders. And she realized that allowing the Lord to work through her and to help her forgive her husband was something that she needed to let him do. And he did it. It wasn't her strength, it was him. And that ultimately all that hate and bitterness and anger was a burden for her. And he had taken that burden away. So that was one of the lessons she learned. Another big thing that happened to her was she, reading the scripture, she felt very strongly that she needed to be baptized. And this was no small decision. Because in Pakistan, a Muslim who is baptized is a Muslim who has fully renounced their faith and become a Christian. There were many cases, and she knew of one actually that had happened fairly recently in her village. A woman had been found murdered in a side alley, and she'd been a Muslim, and her family, well, they did investigate, but they didn't find anything, but everyone knew it was her brother or an uncle that had killed her because she'd been baptized. She was a Muslim, she'd been baptized, and she was murdered. So this happened in Pakistan, and Muslims knew that baptism for Christians was a serious thing because baptism was their symbol that they were going to follow the Lord and they were going to follow Jesus, and that's the way they were going to walk. So Muslims knew that baptism was serious. And so if someone was baptized, they knew that that person had fully renounced Islam. But when Bilquis was reading the Bible, she saw that it was a command, and she saw that she needed to be baptized. And she, of course, the first thought was fear. Her family would find out, of course. There's no hiding it from them. And, you know, and not only her family, but just the whole village, everyone would know. And she was such a sort of an important figure, an influential person. And she thought, this is a step. This is a huge step. But she knew it was the right thing. And the Lord showed her very clearly, it is now your time to be baptized. You need to do it, and do it now. And so she went and visited her missionary friends. And she said to them, and there were some other missionaries there from another village, and she said to them, I want to be baptized. And they said, are you sure? Because they knew the significance of this. And she said, yes, I know that the Lord has told me and he's telling me to do it now. Can we do it now? And so, and they were quite shocked and so on. And so they made arrangements and they ended up traveling and they went to a bigger city and she was baptized. And she knew it was the right thing to do. But as she came back home, her servants were all in a flurry. There'd been phone calls. There'd been visitors. People had called on her and the servants, and she said, oh, who's called? Who's come? He said, oh, you know, auntie this, uncle that, this person, that person. And there's been 3 phone calls. And just that evening, somebody called her and said, Bilquis, we're hearing rumors. You're visiting Christian people. You went to the missionaries. What is this about? And Bilquis, we hear that you've got a Bible. Why have you got a Bible? Bilquis, we hear this, we hear that. And suddenly she was just inundated. Her family had found out. She didn't know. Rumors spread. And suddenly she was just, people were calling left, right and center, and she had to say, yes, it's true. And not only that, but I've been baptized and I'm a Christian. And she knew she couldn't hide it. She knew it was something that needed to be public and out there. And so she told them, and phones were slammed down. People shook their head and left her. People said, call on us no more. You know, that's it. If you have chosen this path, you are on your own. She got phone calls that, you know, in the middle of the night, and she'd pick it up and someone would be screaming down the earpiece, infidel, infidel. And she knew that this was going to be a hard road. Soon after, the missionaries had come over to her house. She'd invited them over, and they were looking around at this beautiful house she lived in, and they said, this is not safe. Look at these huge glass windows that open onto gardens and things like that. You'll need to do something. You'll need to put some sort of grilling on these windows. This is way too open. You're not safe in here. And Bilquis also realized that her life had completely changed. She didn't have this luxury anymore of just kind of relaxing at home with her windows wide open. Suddenly things had changed. And so she thought to herself, yes, maybe they're right. Maybe I need to put these metal grills. And she started to get quotes and ring people and so on. And suddenly she felt like that glory, the presence of the Lord, faded. And she stopped and she put her phone down and she said, Lord, but, you know, what is it? And suddenly she realized what sort of testimony she would be. There she was, a new Christian, just baptized. And there she was getting metal grills on all the windows and doors and barring everyone out. And she thought, what sort of testimony is this? This is the testimony that now I believe in God, I have great fear. That's not the right testimony. And so she thought to herself, no, I will trust him completely. He has led me here quite directly. He's taken me on this path, so he will protect me. And if my time comes, my time comes. And so she cancelled everything. And she had no metal grills anywhere. And she still lived that same life with the open house and so on. And she trusted him completely for that. But then her daughter came, and her daughter was in such a state about what had happened. And a couple of her nieces came and they paid her a visit, and Toonie was absolutely beside herself. She was so angry and upset and confused. And she said, Mum, what have you done? Don't you realize you are so selfish? Just because you wanted to read this book, you changed everything. You're so selfish. Don't you realize what it's done for me? Don't you realize what it's done? You know, she was, and this was true, because Bilquis had become a Christian, other members of the family, their marriage prospects were not as good anymore because the family was shamed. And so Toonie was saying, you know, all these nieces that you have, you think of no one but yourself. What have you done? And then Toonie broke down, and Bilquis realized the real concern. Toonie was so scared because she knew that her mum, Bilquis, would be ruled by any court to be an unfit mother, and Mahmood would be taken away, and Mahmood wouldn't be given to Toonie either because of the shame in the family. That she'd be just given to the husband and his family as custody, and they might not have access to this little boy anymore. And Toonie was so angry and upset and said, he could be taken away, and any court would rule that. No court would rule that you would be a fit mother anymore, and what are we going to do? Maybe you should leave the country. Maybe you should get out of here. We have to think about this. We have to work it out. And she was so upset and angry. And Bilquis herself was so scared just seeing her daughter in this state, and also thinking about what it meant for the little boy, this five-year-old boy. And so she just went to her room and she opened the Bible and said, Lord, I don't know what to do. And Toonie is so upset, and this is a real issue. What will happen to Mahmood? Please show me what will happen to this boy. And she felt like the Lord was showing her where to look. And she opened her Bible at Genesis, and it was as if the Lord was sort of highlighted a verse as she opened. And the verse she read was, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And she read that verse and felt calm, and she knew that the Lord would in some way protect Mahmood, and that They didn't need to do anything. She didn't need to flee the country or do any sort of tricky legal arrangements or anything like that. She knew that the Lord would in some way protect Mahmud. And so she showed this verse to Tuni, and she also was calmed by this. And for the first time in several weeks, she smiled. And she was able just to play with her son and not be anxious and totally hysterical at times as well. Now, her family, a few weeks after her baptism, totally avoided her. And they said they'd do this. They told her, you're on your own. And they did not contact her. And there was like a boycott. And she wasn't invited to anything. She never heard any news. Nobody called her. Nobody visited. And it's like she did not exist. And even though previously she had wanted her peace and she'd sort of told visitors to go and so on, now she was desperate to see just any other, for some company, because she was just so lonely. And this boycott continued. And one day, you know, she's feeling so sad about this and so terribly lonely. And her maid, Nurjan, one of her maids, came and said to her, oh, Madam Sheikh, I thought you might like to know, but I heard from the village that your nephew, Karim, he's died. And Bilquis was just like, what? Nobody told me? I didn't know? And Nurjan said that the funeral is tomorrow, and then she just left. And Bilquis was so upset. This young man, Karim, was actually used to take Mahmud out fishing and stuff like this, and suddenly, for some reason, he just died really suddenly. But no one had told her, and she just realized her isolation, that she wouldn't even know when close family members passed away. No one would tell her. And so she felt, though, that the Lord told her to go to the funeral. And she said, Lord, no, I can't take advantage of my family at this point. And the Lord said very clearly to her, you're to go. And she had learned along the way that the way to stay in the Lord's presence is to obey. It's very, very simple. And so she knew that she needed to go to this funeral. And so she went and, of course, turned a lot of heads. People were sort of, you know, they looked at her with disdain, like, why was she coming at this time? But she went and she sat. And then she went to Karim's mother and she embraced her and just said a few words of condolence to this woman. And then she left. And another week passed, and there was another funeral. And again she found out through her servants about another family member. This time a young child had died suddenly. And again she felt the Lord say, go to that funeral. And so she went. And again she was there and she comforted the parents of this young child. And then she sort of thought, Lord, why? I mean, I go there and I just comfort them and I say a few words. I don't even mention you. Of course I can't. And she thought, why did the Lord prompt her to go? And a week later, she got a phone call from Karim's mother. And Karim's mother sort of said, I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you for what you said. You brought a lot of comfort to me. And Bilquis thought, didn't really say very much at all. And again, another phone call from the other family, and they said, thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it. And, you know, the husband said, my wife found great comfort in you being there and the things you said. And Bilquis thought, Lord, I was there for like, I spoke to these people for less than 2 minutes. I didn't say anything. I didn't mention you. But the Lord taught her that she was a representative, and the Lord was sending her to these places as his representative. And she realized that the Lord had worked through her and comforted these people himself through her. And so she realized then that she could be this representative for the Lord in places where he was not represented at all. She went to Lahore and she found a place which sold Bibles. She bought 100 Bibles. She found another place that had tracts. She bought thousands and thousands of Christian tracts. And she started to leave them in places. She left them in restaurants. She left them in sort of public places like toilets and anywhere she could. And she thought, you know, I need to do something here because the Lord can work through me. Soon her family started to send people to visit her. They were Muslims who used to be Christians. So they were Christians who'd converted to Islam. And they were often Western people, like, you know, British. And she knew that her family thought, oh, you know, they just think that I'm going to be swayed because he's an educated British person. And so they, you know, she would talk with these people who would come and call on her and try and persuade her that she was wrong in her thinking. But they would end up with things to think about and leaving with their, you know, scratching their head and thinking about things. But she never saw any results. And in fact, one day she walked into a bathroom that she'd put tracks in, and she put piles of tracks. And she was really encouraged because there was like only a few left. But then she looked into the bin, and the bin was just full of these scrunched up tracks. And so she thought to herself, Lord, why? You know, I'm doing all this and I'm trying. I'm, you know, all these people that come to my house, I'm debating with them, I'm speaking with them, I'm being your representative, but I've never, ever seen any results. There's nothing, you know. I've not seen anyone change or anything, not even a word. And the Lord spoke to her very clearly and said, when you were speaking with these people, when you were buying these Bibles and giving them, when you were putting the tracts in all these places, was I with you? Did you feel my presence? And she said, yes, yes, Lord, I know it's the right thing to do. And then he said, your job is to obey. My job is the results. And so from then on, she let go of this idea of needing to see results. And she just obeyed. And whenever the Lord told her to put tracts here or put this there, she would do it. And it was as simple as that. Now, time. Am I all right for time? Can I keep going for a little bit?
Yeah.
One other story she had was when she was in a garden one day, and she had this beautiful, as I said, she has beautiful, beautiful gardens, and she had this lovely tree quite near her house, and the village children had snuck into her garden, had climbed the tree and were picking the ripe fruit and eating it, and they were throwing it and having fun and squealing and so on. And she was annoyed because this was her rest time, and she marched out and told the servants to get the kids out of her estate, get them out of the tree. And in fact, in her rage and anger at being disturbed by these scatty children, she actually said to the gardener, cut down the tree. And so the gardener sort of got the chainsaw and cut down this beautiful fruit tree. And she felt instantly the glory fade, the Lord's presence. And she instantly realized and thought that, there we go, the old Madam Sheikh has come out again. And she saw what she'd done, the tree on the ground there. And so she repented. And she said to the Lord, I need to change, and thank you for helping me learn. The next day, she invited every child from the village to come, and she said to them, you can go to my orchard and you can have all the fruit you want and have a nice time. And she invited them in, and all the children came. It was like the Lord was going to go, okay, well, let's see how you go here. And so all the children came, the poorest and everything, and they ransacked her gardens. They pulled all the fruit, they ate it, they threw it, they dropped it, they stomped on all her flowers. All her beautiful fountains had got fruit pips in them and everything. And she looked out on the total mess, and she said, yes, Lord, it's your garden, not mine. So she learnt to lay down everything. And then the next day, it was like the Lord said, okay, I'm going to teach you a few lessons here. A lady came, and this lady was very poor, and she had a sick child with her. And Mahmoud ran to Bilquis and said, Mama, there's a lady here, she wants to see you. And Bilquis said, but it's my rest time. You know well enough that I have this 1 hour of the day where no one disturbs me, including you. Now go. And Mahmoud ran off. But then she felt the Lord saying, excuse me? And again, his presence faded. And so she went down and she apologized to Mahmoud and said, Mahmoud, actually get the servants to bring the lady in. And so the lady came in and was holding the baby, and she was, the baby was really sick. And so Bilquis said, you know, what do you want me to do? And the lady said, well, I heard that you are a bit holy. Can you pray for my baby? Because we have no money, we cannot afford the doctor, my husband is unemployed, and my baby is so sick. And so Bilquis, you know, prayed for this woman and had her sit down, and then called the servants to bring food, pack food, and said to her, look, this baby needs the hospital, go to the hospital, I will pay for all the medical expenses. And if your husband has any trouble finding work, I will help him myself. So come back and let me know. And so this woman and her baby went, and she thought to herself, Bilquis thought, you know, there were times before in her old life where she would even be upset if the shadow of a poor, low-class person crossed her. And she would feel defiled. But here she was inviting this person in her house and actually caring for them, and she thought, the Lord has really changed me. But that woman, she was a week, and she heard nothing back from that lady, and so she talked to her servants, who always knew everything, and she said to Nurjan, what happened to that lady and the baby, the one that came the other week? And Nurjan said, oh, no, the baby's well now. They had the medicine from the hospital, everything's good. And actually, yes, the husband has work. And Bilquis was so angry. She said, she was so ungrateful. Why didn't she come and tell me? At least she could have said thank you after all I did for her. And then she stopped again and realized that the Lord was saying, no. And again, she thought, there we are again. Even though I had done all this and the Lord had taught me, she was seeing it as her own work. And she was seeing that she had that pride that she had done so much for this person and that person wasn't grateful. And so she learned another lesson that time too. Now the warnings at this point were coming thick and fast. Even Mahmud, who went and played with some of the village boys, came back one day and said, Mama, these kids I'm playing with, they say that they're going to kill us, that somebody is going to kill us. They're going to kill me and you. And Bilquis was really scared, and she gathered this, he was about 7 years old at this time, she gathered Mahmud up and said, you know, we need to trust the Lord. We need to trust him. You know, it might be that people have harm, they want to do harm, but we need to know that it's all in God's timing and he is in control. And Mahmud accepted that and he ran off and played. But the servants started hearing rumors. One of them came to her in private and said, we've heard from the village, the people at the mosque, they were talking, they've been planning, they're planning an attack, they're going to attack you. You know, family members rang and said, you know, you better watch out, you better think about yourself. And she started getting these strange warnings, and she knew that something was going to happen, that it was unlikely that she would just live a peaceful life. And so one day, after sort of troubling herself about these things and worrying and again committing everything to the Lord and saying, whatever happens, Lord, it's yours and I put my life into your hands. One afternoon she went up to her room and she was praying as usual. And Mahmud was asleep in another bedroom upstairs. And it was a warm afternoon. And she went into her room and she was about to kneel by her bed. And suddenly she felt the Lord saying, get out now. And she jumped to her feet. It was like she needed to run. And she ran out and she ran to Mahmud's room and she just grabbed him. He was fast asleep and he was like struggling, not knowing what happened. She just ran and she ran down the stairs and she screamed at the servants, get out, get out, get out. And the servants rushed out and they came out and she felt really silly because she didn't even know why. But she had that great sense of urgency and she rushed out of the house. And the minute she stepped out of the house, she realized the whole side of her house was on fire. Someone had piled up dry wood, lit it with petrol, and the whole thing was up. And of course the servants ran, they got the buckets, they got water from the stream, they came, they put water on it and they managed to get the fire under control, but that whole side of her house was burnt. And she realized that the Lord had helped her escape at that point, because had she knelt and prayed, Mahmud was asleep, the servants were about doing their thing, they would have been enveloped in flames in no time. And from that point, she felt the Lord tell her, even just straight after that happened, because of course there was an investigation and there was found nothing. But after that point, the Lord told her, I want you out of here. I want you to leave Pakistan. And at first she fought this feeling, and she thought to herself, Pakistan, this is my country. I have served this country. It is my country. It's been my country for 700 years. I have family history. You want me to leave my family, my whole family, and go where? And the Lord was telling her very clearly that he had new things for her to do, and she was to leave and go to America. And she thought, America of all places, I don't know, I don't know the culture, I don't know what these pale people do. And she was very scared about it, but she felt like the Lord was very clear and said to her, you need to leave, and now. And so she ended up leaving her garden, leaving her estate, leaving everything, traveling with Mahmoud, and together her and Mahmoud found themselves very short, only months after this, on a plane headed to America. She had no idea what the Lord wanted her to do there. And she had no idea. She still felt this tug at leaving her country and her identity, her family, everything, and to go into the unknown, a completely new culture, completely new everything. But she knew that the Lord wanted her to do this. And she'd learnt those lessons earlier, that to live in his presence is to obey. And so she said to herself on the plane, here I am, going to this new place, new culture, new everything, but actually nothing's changed because I'm still in his presence. And that's where I'll leave it.